Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said today that schools across the state can reopen. He said individual districts can decide the timing of their reopening as long as coronavirus transmission rates remain low. In Illinois, Governor J.B. Pritzker said new rules he's proposing will fine businesses and schools up to $2,500 for violating the statewide mask mandate and restrictions on social gatherings.
Let's go to Ohio now, where health officials are reporting a daily record of more than 1,700 new cases. And just yesterday, Governor Mike DeWine first tested positive for COVID-19 right before an expected meeting with President Trump, then tested negative. Governor Mike DeWine joins us now, and welcome to Here and Now, Governor.
Well, good to be with you. Thank you very much.
What a day you had yesterday. What have you taken away from what happened to you? I mean, it really speaks to concerns people have that we can't really rely on testing to find our way out of this pandemic.
Well, I think we can rely a lot on testing, and I hope people don't take the impression from what happened to me yesterday. And it was kind of a roller coaster day, I'll tell you that, to indicate that we can't use this testing. Testing is very, very important. And I've learned a lot, frankly, in the last 24 hours. This was a test that was done for me and for anybody else who was going to meet the president yesterday in Cleveland. But it was an antigen test. I'm told that they can have an error rate up to about 30%.
That's significant.
Well, it's very significant. And what happened with me is I tested positive, which was a big shock to me. Of course, I didn't see the president. I got in my car and went back home. But I stopped at Ohio State, and my wife and I both were tested there, along with four or five of our staff members who were always very close to me. And we learned last night we all came back negative. They ran it again just to make sure, and that came back negative. And so we think we're fine. We're going to, out of caution, we're going to have another test done on Saturday.
Okay, so you've had multiple tests. Most Americans, though, can't have multiple tests right now. They're still, depending on where you are in the country, varying degrees and accessibility to getting tests. This week, you joined the governors of six other states in what is being thought of as the first coordinated multi-state testing partnership. What do you hope to achieve with this?
Well, it's really buying power. It's kind of basic economics going together. We want to be able to assure anyone that we're dealing with that they're going to be able to have a good market. And by putting all these states together, we've got a market that is taken care of. So we're very, very happy about that.
You're a Republican, as we know, and just yesterday, President Trump called you a great friend. But does the fact that you need to join a partnership like this imply that the Trump administration has failed on testing? I mean, is the president doing enough to stop this pandemic?
Look, I think one of the lessons from this pandemic, after it's all over and we all look back, there's a couple lessons. One is we've underinvested in public health. And we've done this under Democrat and Republican administrations alike. We've done it for decades. We've got to invest more in public health. Number two, we don't ever want to be in a position, again, where we have to buy all our medical equipment from China or from Europe. We need to be able to produce this stuff inside the United States.
I want to ask you more about what's happening in Ohio. So you were praised for keeping infections low in Ohio in the early stages of this pandemic. Over the course of 4 days back in mid-March, you shut down schools before any other state, and then bars and gyms and salons, and then instituted a stay-at-home order. But now we're seeing caseloads are spiking again in your state. What went wrong?
Well, we reopened the state. It's what's happened across the country. Now, we did it very carefully. We did it in stages. We have the best protocols for business But what's happened is that, you know, for a while people were not wearing masks. We put on a statewide mask order, and we're seeing the mask compliance go up dramatically. And there is good news. In the urban areas, we're starting to see our cases go down. And that's a direct result of about 90% of the people who are out and about are wearing masks. What we're seeing, however, on the downside, we're seeing our rural areas where we're seeing a spread. And quite frankly, we've got to get our mask compliance up there.
Yeah, I mean, mask wearing, though, has become so political. You've actually been criticized for advocating that people wear them. Your chief health advisor resigned after facing threats and backlash over the response to this pandemic. You're one of the governors who's been praised for listening to scientists. What do you say to people who don't?
Well, the evidence is overwhelming. I used to be a county prosecutor, and in this regard, the jury is back. There is a verdict, and the verdict clearly is that mask wearing makes a big difference, and so does social distancing.
Do you feel the president shares any responsibility, though, for politicizing mask wearing?
Look, I think that the evidence is clear. I think the fact that the president is seen now sometimes wearing masks is a very, very positive thing. I wear a mask everywhere I go out. It's the right thing to do, and I think, you know, I need to set the tone for the state. So it is getting people used to that this is something that they can do. It's not a loss of freedom. I look at it as a way to gain freedom. This enables us, if everyone's wearing a mask and we're keeping social distance, we can start schools back up.
We know that your neighboring state of Kentucky is now shutting down bars and reducing restaurant capacity and those things after seeing a spike in cases. Do you regret opening up over the last few weeks? And are you ready to go back to doing that in Ohio?
Well, we've limited bars. They have to shut down at 10 o'clock now, and that is one step. And we're going to continue to monitor what's going on. And I've not ruled out any future action.
Mike DeWine is the governor of Ohio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
The U.S. job market continued its growth for the third month in a row, but it lost a bit of steam last month. Today, the Labor Department reports 1.8 million jobs were added in July. That's a sharp decline from June, when employers added 4.8 million jobs. NPR's chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley is here. And Scott, since the pandemic, we have seen one of the fastest rebounds ever in the labor market, and now we're seeing a slowdown of that growth. Tell us what's happening.
The pandemic itself is probably the biggest headwind right now. We do see signs that economic activity has been slowing as the number of new coronavirus infections has been climbing. Some of that is because of new restrictions, like the governor just talked about. Some of it's just consumers being more careful about going out and spending money. It's certainly encouraging that employers added 1.8 million jobs last month and the unemployment rate dipped to 10.2%. But as you point out, that's less than half the number of jobs that were added in June. And with tens of millions of people still out of work, it could take a long time to climb out of this still very deep hole we're in.
Well, let's look specifically at the leisure and hospitality sector, which has been slammed by the pandemic. Things have improved since states have allowed bars and restaurants to reopen, one would think. How did that sector fare in July?
Restaurants added 500,000 jobs, more than a quarter of all the jobs that were added last month. That's positive. But employment in the leisure and hospitality industries is still way below where it was before this started back in February. I spoke to a restaurant owner in Chicago this morning. He can only use about 25% of his ordinary seating capacity. He has added some outdoor seating and even put a tent on a rooftop, so he's certainly getting creative. But, you know, patio dining in Chicago might not be very appealing as the weather turns colder in the fall and winter. So there's a lot of challenges out there.
Meanwhile, lawmakers in Washington are still at odds over a relief bill, especially on extending the unemployment benefits that gave jobless Americans $600 more a week. That money has run out, and it's pretty scary for people, including this woman who one of our producers spoke with. Her name is Betsy Burke. She's in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Her husband's income is what is supporting them, and she said they're basically relying on credit cards and the kindness of neighbors. Let's listen.
Somebody had taped an envelope to our front door with a $100 gift card for a grocery store. And that's how you get by.
So, Scott Horsley, what are the millions of unemployed Americans like Betsy doing?
Yeah, it's going to be tough. I mean, for much of this pandemic, the government was effectively taping $600 gift cards to people's doors every week, and that was a really important life support. Those payments have now stopped. They made a big difference not only in people's ability to pay the rent or the air conditioning bill or make their car payments, but it was also an important support for the broader economy. The jobs numbers in June were really strong, and some lawmakers seem to think they could just wait for the economy to heal on its own. It looks increasingly now like that's not going to happen. So maybe that'll light a fire under policymakers here in Washington to make a deal. Otherwise, we could see even weaker job growth come August.
Just briefly, how could it be that, as the Labor Department reports that another 1.2 million Americans filed for initial jobless claims, jobs are being lost and added at the same time?
Right. There's always some churn. It's a dynamic economy. The jobless claims last week were down from the week before, which is good, but they've been more than a million a week ever since the spring. So we're not out of the woods by a long shot.
Scott Horsley, NPR's chief economics correspondent. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Take care.
In the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, Puerto Rico was one of the first to impose the strictest lockdowns of the United States. Governor Wanda Vazquez restricted what days people could go out, enacting an overnight curfew, and those who violated it could be fined thousands of dollars in jail time. But in the months since, the number of people with COVID-19 has grown, with more than 18,000 confirmed cases. And as hurricane season intensifies, Puerto Rico now finds itself exceptionally vulnerable. For more on this, let's bring in Dr. Jose F. Rodriguez Arango. He is the executive director of the Public Health Trust in San Juan. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you for the invitation.
So, Doctor, up until May, Puerto Rico had less than 1% infection rate, and that's really remarkable in a territory with over a million people. But something began to change in July when the island went into phase three. Can you tell us more?
Yes. As you mentioned, after the lockdown, we were in our houses. And from May until the last week of June, our positive rate was less than 1%. So when we opened, everybody was out, and because it was July the 4th, there was a lot of congregations and a lot of individuals that didn't follow the strict orders of distancing and also using the face mask. Also, in addition, during that period of time, we didn't have a great system in the airport. Some of our families coming from Florida and Texas came to visit their relatives here in the island. And the last part that I think that we didn't do well during this period is that although the Puerto Rico Public Health Trust, we were working with some municipalities regarding the contact tracing, the program of the government was not ready at that time. So now is the situation is kind of worrisome because we're still increasing the positive rate every week.
Yeah. The governor has said that $100 million will be released to help municipalities affected by this pandemic and another $150 million to aid private hospitals. But how is all of this playing out in light of the island's health system, which we know collapsed after Hurricane Maria back in 2017? How is testing being done on the island?
Well, regarding the aid for the municipalities, they put together this contact tracing program that is working right now quite well. Regarding the hospitalization rate, at the beginning of July, the occupation was like 46%. And now it's 42%. But regarding the ICUs, two-thirds of the ICUs that are in, that are occupied by different individuals, and some of them are from COVID. In terms of the ventilators, we are only using like 28% of all the ventilators in the island. And remember, at the beginning, we didn't know how to treat these patients. And now our physicians have more tools in their hands in order to make better assessments in their patient population.
My last question for you, doctor, what concerns do you have about people's safety and social distancing as the island prepares for reopening for tourism, which is a major economic driver?
Yeah, the airport has always been our weakest link. So what we expect is that we get more testing for our visitors. At this time, I'm asking my relatives in the States, we love you, but please don't come, because we have proven that during at least 2 months, we could maintain our positivity rate very low. And we want to make sure that we have all the systems in place here in the island in order for us to avoid more of this increase of the COVID-19 pandemic in the island.
That's Dr. Jose F. Rodriguez Arango. He is the executive director of the Public Health Trust in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Dr. Rodriguez Arango, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And like other parts of the continental U.S., the COVID-19 pandemic is happening as the push for social justice continues. Natasha Alford is a journalist for the GRIOT and Pulitzer Center grantee, and she traveled to Puerto Rico shortly after the island's political protests in 2019 to understand another uprising taking place on the land, what she calls the Afro-Latino Revolution. She joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me, Tanya.
Yes, and Natasha, what through lines are you seeing between the Afro-Puerto Rican community and what's happening in other parts of the country in the protests for racial justice? How does PR's history and culture play out in the construction of race and racial experiences?
Yes, so there is so much to unpack there. But, you know, the first thing I'll say is after the death of George Floyd, we immediately saw protests, we saw vigils, and we saw memorials in honor of his life right in Puerto Rico. So obviously there was something that really resonated with people there, and specifically in Afro-Puerto Rican communities. Now, oftentimes when people think of Afro-Puerto Ricans, they may associate them with just one community, one town, one neighborhood. I'll give you an example. Loíza has a really high proportion of residents who identify as Afro-Puerto Rican. But the reality is that there are Black people everywhere in Puerto Rico. It's just as diverse as the United States. And so we saw that what was happening in the continental U.S. was really resonating.
It's resonating because there are similarities. What have you found in terms of health disparities with Afro-Latinos and other types of disparities? Do they mirror what we see in the continental United States?
Yes, I think that there are parallels, and it makes sense, right? Because when you think about the history of Puerto Rico, there was slavery there as well, right? Even though our societies may be different, you know, we think of the continental U.S., we think of segregation and Jim Crow. A lot of people just don't know the history of Puerto Rico and slavery and the aftermath of how it played out. They often assume that Puerto Rico is an island of racial harmony, that it is a racial utopia. The phrase La Gran Familia Puertorriqueña is about being one Puerto Rican family. But a lot of people will tell you that that's actually not the case. And so with health disparities, one thing that researchers have found is that darker-skinned Puerto Ricans report poorer health outcomes. And some of the reasons for that are social treatment, the communities in which they live in are sometimes poorer, exposure to social stressors. There's a great research paper that was written that came out of the University of Puerto Rico by Jose Carabello Cueto and Isar Goudreau, and they talked about changing the way that we measure those disparities by changing the language we use. So we often think of Black and white in the United States, but they did a study where they asked people to list the shade of their skin tone. And when they did that, they actually got more information that showed what those health disparities were. And the key was using the local language and understanding of race rather than trying to impose the continental US's language when it comes to race.
Of course, the U.S. Census is one way race gets defined, and that's now underway. The response, though, has been dismal. Bloomberg News reports that the self-response rate is just 27%. That's the lowest of any U.S. jurisdiction. There are several reasons for this, but I want to ask you about racial identities, how people perceive themselves, and how that view impacts the view of Puerto Rico's population.
Yes. So the census is one of those things that is essential to a community getting the resources that it needs. And that's why it's so heartbreaking that the response rate is so low right now. Not surprising, since people are trying to survive a global pandemic, as well as all of the problems that already plagued Puerto Rico. But in Puerto Rico, we're seeing Black Puerto Rican activists who recognize the power of mobilization. Colectivo ILE is a group of anti-racist women and femmes who are on the island asking people to check Black on the census and to specifically write in Afro-descendant. And they believe that unless people track and see themselves as Black, you will not be able to allocate resources properly to closing racial disparities. You can't track what you don't see. And because there are so many Puerto Ricans who could be identified as Black, but maybe don't see themselves that way or have been discouraged from identifying as Black, they are educating. They are teaching them about Black pride, Black history, things that had been left out of the school curriculum and perhaps contribute to this distancing away from Blackness. And so they believe there's power in education, mobilization, and ultimately tracking Blackness.
Natasha Alford is a journalist for The Griot and Pulitzer Center grantee. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your work.
Thank you so much. And I would encourage everyone to check out our new documentary, Afro-Latinx Revolution, Puerto Rico. It will be appearing on thegriot.com, and you can watch the full story of our experience there.
And we will have all of those details for you at hereandnow.org. A team of French investigators started work in Beirut today, searching for evidence that could explain the cause of Tuesday's massive explosion. Rescuers are still digging through the rubble of Beirut's port. Bulldozers are churning through the debris. And let's go now to Beirut, where that massive cleanup and rescue effort continues. The BBC's Lina Sinjab joins us now. And Lina, where are you, and can you describe what's happening there today?
Well, today we managed to have access closer to the port, to ground zero, where the explosion took place. And actually, where I'm standing, just I can see all the wreckage in front of me. It's just massive, apocalyptic kind of scene. I can see even the storage area where all the explosive were stored, and only like one wall of it that is still standing. And everywhere is covered with dust. Even the ships have been destroyed and blown up. But as I'm talking to you now as well, the rescue operation, the digging and the bulldozers, the ambulances, everyone is there. The operation is still continuing nonstop since the explosion happened.
Those rescuers are looking for survivors, but they're also doing recovery. Is that correct? I mean, it seems almost impossible that there could be any survivors.
Well, basically, you know, there are several teams. Some teams are, you know, dedicated to removing the rubbles. Others are rescuers. And every 5 or 10 minutes or even more, you hear the ambulances going in. Probably they found someone and they take him or her out. We're not sure at this moment. We're just watching what's happening. As I'm talking to you, I can see the crane and I can see the bulldozer trying to remove the rubbles. But it's a big operation that, you know, one country on its own, especially like Lebanon with all the troubles troubles that has been going on with all the financial crisis and actually the inefficiency of the state. They can't do it on their own. That's why so far we've heard from several international, from several countries around the world, even from the region that they've sent in, rescue team, medical aid, humanitarian aid, and even some security expert to help assess the situation at the port.
Yeah, we've been hearing a lot about what people are feeling about the government there. There's a lot of anger because of the state of the region before this happened. A lot of finger pointing to government negligence. Does anyone believe there will be any accountability for what happened?
No one trusts the government at all. There is zero trust to the government, and there is, furious anger against every single politician who is in power. Remind our audience that most of the politicians now, or the political elite, are the warlords of the civil war, are the ones who had blood on their hands during the wartime. And now they're super rich. They've capped on the wealth that they have taken from their position in power. And they left the country, sinking in economic crisis and financial crisis, and now even in safety. They feel that, they took to the streets in 2019 angry about the politics, angry about the economy, about corruption. But now it's their own safety, it's their own life that they don't trust the government is going to help them. One more thing, which is very important. Yesterday, we've seen the French president, Emmanuel Macron, going to the streets, meeting people, talking to them, hearing their agony. And 4 days, we are today 4 days into the explosion, and not a single official from the Lebanese government or the political elite took to the street to meet people or talk to them or tap on their shoulders.
That's the BBC's Lina Sinjab in Beirut. Lina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been following the case of an investigative journalist named Hopewell Chinono. Recently, his reporting helped expose massive overbilling in a government contract for personal protective gear to fight COVID-19 in Zimbabwe, his home country. Nearly 3 weeks ago, police broke into Chinono's home. They arrested him and accused him of incitement to commit public violence. Yesterday, a court denied him bail again. Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian spent almost 2 years in jail in Iran on espionage charges. He was released in 2016. He joins us now on Skype. Jason, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me on, Lisa.
You say there is a direct link between the coronavirus and the aggressive arrest and detention of journalists, including Hopewell Chinono. I want to tell you something that just before our interview, I heard from Human Rights Watch, which is watching Chinono's case very carefully. And I should say that Chinono and I were journalists the same year in a journalism fellowship at Harvard. And so I do have a personal interest in what's happening as well as a professional one. This person from Human Rights Watch said that he understands Hopewell has been stopped from wearing COVID-19 protective clothing and goggles in prison because they're deemed a security risk. This is a prison that's known to be filthy in the best of circumstances. But this seems like such an aggressive move against a journalist for whom there hasn't even been a trial date set yet. What do you think is going on there?
Well, I think that this is a trend that authoritarians and even some democracies around the world are very callously and opportunistically using this pandemic and the coverage of this pandemic as a pretense to arrest people, arrest journalists, and detain them for long periods of time, often without trial, but then put them into prisons where they face much greater risk of contracting the coronavirus. Just last month, three journalists that we know of died in prison because of coronavirus-related illnesses that they contracted while being detained. And these cases seem unrelated, but when you look at it, it's a broader trend that's happening around the world. And unfortunately, journalists who should be considered essential workers in some countries are being targeted for persecution at this time And it's become a pretty simple way for governments to shut down dissent. And so I doubt that there's any difference in Zimbabwe than there is in Kyrgyzstan or Egypt or Honduras or any of the other places where this is happening right now.
So that's where these other journalists died, you said, from COVID-19.
Yes. And I mean, there have been journalists who have died from COVID-19 covering the story, right? But, you know, to take people into custody, knowing that they're at risk of contracting this disease, it's barbaric.
And in this case, if this reporter, Hopewell Chinono, is being told to remove his gear, this sounds like it is another way to try to permanently silence a journalist. Are these governments trying to kill journalists?
It's too difficult to say from afar that they're trying to kill these journalists by making them contract the disease. I can't say that with any sort of definitive conviction, but it would appear so. And that's a terrible thing. And I've been in contact with folks at the UN Human Rights Commission who say that there is a good chance that if brought to courts of international justice, the leaderships of these countries would be found guilty of extrajudicial killings in these cases. Yes.
And can anything be done to stop them before it even gets to that point?
Well, I think, you know, traditionally, Lisa, the U.S. president and State Department have been the most ardent supporters of free expression and protection of journalists around the world. Unfortunately, I don't need to tell you that responsibility was abdicated 3 years ago, almost four now, when President Trump took office. He has been complicit in many ways in the closing down of free expression around the world, and also, you know, tacitly given a green light to autocrats who want to kill journalists. The most obvious example is the response to the killing of my colleague Jamal Khashoggi. It's been a horrible thing to watch from up close here in Washington, D.C., as our commitment to the First Amendment and free expression has waned so much that I worry that it'll be hard to resuscitate.
Well, what about other governments? We know that South Africa, a neighbor to Zimbabwe, has been watching and assigning a monitor specifically to find out what's happening in the Zimbabwe prisons. What about the African Union? What about organizations even outside the continent? It sounds like the government and these prisons are almost impermeable. Is that the case?
Well, you know, speaking from my own experience in prison in Iran, yes, they are impermeable. You know, there is no oversight in a lot of these prisons. And while I do believe that other African governments can lean on the leadership of Zimbabwe in this case, I don't think that that is necessarily enough. I mean, I think there needs to be a more concerted effort around promoting the freedom and safety of journalists around the world. And what we're seeing right now during the pandemic is the exact opposite. There hasn't been any phenomenon, event, or trend that's been more destructive to press freedom more quickly than COVID-19. It even seems to be taking effect more quickly than the war on terror following 9/11, which was previously sort of the most destructive attack on press freedom globally.
Say more about that. You say there hasn't been any other event in recent history that has provided more occasion to restrict press freedom than COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a partisan issue. It's not a political issue. It's a matter of public health. Many governments who were caught unprepared for the pandemic prefer to suppress information about the spread of the disease within their own borders. So when journalists do their job, rather than allow those stories to be told, governments have instead taken the approach of locking journalists up, you know, under the auspices that these journalists have somehow disrupted the national security. Whenever you see a journalist accused of espionage, terrorism, what it really means is that they were doing their job exposing corruption by the governments that they cover.
Jason, remind us when you were in prison in Iran, what helped get you out?
Well, I think that in all of these cases, there is a choice to be made. And that choice, first and foremost, is within the family. Are we going to hope for the best and wish this thing to be resolved quietly and without intervention? Or are we going to step in and be vocal and adamant that our loved one is innocent and should be free? I'm fortunate that my family chose the latter route, and in coordination with my employers at the Washington Post, they were able to mount a very public advocacy campaign on my behalf that was so effective that the U.S. government had to take note. And this notion that such cases will be resolved quietly and that, you know, governments will magically do the right thing without any sort of public pressure is a fairy tale.
So just to finish that thought, you're not saying that it's just up to the Zimbabwe government to do the right thing here. You're saying it's up to the U.S. government as well.
I think it's up to all responsible democratic governments to step in and be the vanguard of protecting press freedom. And traditionally, that has fallen on the United States of America. And our intervention has been a reliable predictor that an oppressed journalist will see freedom if the U.S. government steps in. And when we don't, their chances are not as good.
Jason Rezaian, opinions writer for The Washington Post, talking about the detention of journalists such as Hopewell Chinunu in Zimbabwe during the COVID-19 pandemic. Jason, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Sports leagues are keeping fans happy with games conducted within quarantine bubbles. And now there's thinking that the same model might work for TV production. At least that's what media mogul Tyler Perry is trying. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us to talk about this. Welcome.
Hi.
So, Eric, Tyler Perry presented a detailed plan on how he'd produce shows through the pandemic, and now it actually seems to be working. What do we know about his experiment?
Yeah, so he was very detailed in the plan that he laid out. The way that it worked is that he would have cast and crew get tested in their hometown. Mm-hmm. They self-isolate after they test, presuming that they would test negative. And then they fly to Atlanta. They get tested again, and again, assuming that they get negative testing. Then they're quarantined on this facility, and they get regular tests every few days. Mm. And then when they did the production, they didn't have any outbreaks, so they were feeling pretty good about their system.
Mm. That's interesting. You know, I use the comparison of sports teams. We know, based on what's been happening with some of those teams, that these types of bubbles aren't foolproof, even with all of these measures. Do you think, though, that other TV studios could follow Perry's lead?
The lesson to me is that it adds a lot of extra time to a production, which costs money. And all of this testing is expensive. And, you know, given all of the controversy about how fast testing results may come in now for the general public because so many people are trying to get tested, the idea that, you know, Hollywood would want to consume all of these tests, that's also going to be another question. Can that happen? And how will people feel if, you know, all these productions are consuming so much of the testing facilities in a place like California or Atlanta or New York?
Right. But it could be a possible solution. So many people depend on the entertainment industry for employment. I guess weighing out whether the pros outweigh the cons as far as cost on the money you're losing from no production versus being able to offer it in this way, it'll be an interesting one to watch for sure. I want to ask you about Quibi. So as we know, it's a mobile-only streamer, and it launched a few months ago. They released a remake of The Fugitive. Is it worth signing up for the streaming service to see this?
How much do you like hate-watching shows?
Ooh. Oh, boy. Question. Say more.
So I watched, I think I watched the first five episodes, quote unquote episodes. You know, you get the sense when you're watching it that it feels like it's almost like a TV movie that's been chopped up. You know, The Fugitive is a classic TV show. A guy's falsely accused of crime. He goes on the run. And there's this odd sort of bond slash antagonism with the lead police officer, law enforcement person who's tasked with finding him. David Janssen starred in the classic TV show, and then Harrison Ford starred in a very popular movie about it.
Yeah.
And Tommy Lee Jones played the law enforcement officer who was chasing him. So now we have right. we have a version on Quibi, and Kiefer Sutherland, who people may know from 24, plays the law enforcement officer who's tracking the fugitive. Let's just listen to a clip of him playing this character because it's so over the top and so ridiculous.
Hey, everybody, listen up. We're about to get our warrants for Mike Farrow's house, car, and computer. If his dog has fleas, I want them confiscated. And I get a copy ball.
Copy ball!
These are to my ears. One more thing, superstars. Everything about this case stays on the QT. Whatever you know, put it in a bag, toss it off the Santa Monica Pier.
Can't we amp up the pressure on Farrow if we leak him as a person of interest?
Why would you want to tip him off? Right now he thinks he's gotten away with it. That's when he'll make his mistake. Absolutely no one says the words Mike Farrow to the press. Understood?
Now, don't you do that in a newsroom? You know, you sort of bark out an order and say, give me a copy, boss! Copy, boss! The one thing I've learned from watching this show is how good Tommy Lee Jones was in the film, because he said lines that were similar but made them sound realistic and authentic and cool. Kiefer Sutherland just sounds, you know, he doesn't sound cool. Let's just put it that way.
Well, it sounds like what you're giving, though, is critique of the actual performance versus the platform and this show being in this really short 10-minute or less episode model? Or do you think that it just doesn't work in this model compounded by the acting and production?
I think it's both. Part of the problem is the format of Quibi, I think, makes it hard for them to create this kind of long-form dramatic programming that will hold your attention. You really have to have a sense that a project is crafted for Quibi. And so far, when I've watched these longer dramatic things, it doesn't feel like they were crafted for Quibi. It just feels like it's become the stop of last resort for people who are pitching projects around Hollywood. So these projects we're seeing, it doesn't feel like, oh, you know, they got a great show that everybody wanted, but it's on Quibi. And I think that's something they need to work on.
Yeah, along with just getting people to sign up for the service, which has been a challenge during the pandemic. That's NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans, as always. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.